Discussion. It would have been great to kind of go on for quite a bit longer there just to probe this in depth, because I think you're stirring up some ideas with folks. Before we begin with each of you, what I'd like to do is ask a question of the audience, which deals with what Andreas presented here, and just by a show of hands, I'm curious to find out how many of you consider yourselves either an e-business, a me business, or a we business. All right, so by a show of hands, how many of you are an e-business by what you defined today? Show us your hands. 15-20%. All right, how about me business? How many of you are me business? Okay, all right, a little over that. Good. Any we business folks out there? Oh, well, look at this. This is good. You've already had impact. It happened within the first 5 minutes. That's great. Well, listen, let's get to that and ask the same question to our panelists, because I'd like to find out a bit about how you, based on what we've heard today, this notion of E versus me versus we, and how similar concepts are maybe occurring in your businesses, if we could. And Andrew, why don't we start with you just to get a sense of whether you consider yourself an e-business, a me business, or a we business. Then we've got microphones.
This is an embarrassing question.
I'm sorry.
For someone who is balding and definitely not Gen Y, and representing a legacy business, which is banking. And definitely, I would say we are in the e-business.
Okay. All right, good. We got an e-business person here. Andreas, I'm going to ask you.
I think it's certainly in me business, and to the degree that I'm interested in relations, it's a we business. And I think the we business is certainly moving on with all of us. And the distinctions are not as hard as actually it sounded. Yeah. Amazon partially is also a we business, and to some degree, a we business.
Sure. And certainly from the dialogue you showed, the conversations with some of the other folks, like Esther Dyson as well, it indicates a two-way conversation. Everyone?
As you know, I come from Singtel, so obviously I'm in the E, the me, and the we, but I think to my bosses I'm in the M business, that's money, to be honest.
Michael.
I think you have to be in all three, but at this point in time we are still more in the me.
In the me
more in the E, with a great influence in the me, but still more in the E.
Yeah. Well, tell me a bit about what you're learning in your business from your customers, about your customers. Michael, since you've got the microphone, maybe you want to touch on that a bit.
Sure. Well, again, I mean, our customers, as I'm sure with my colleagues, are broad-based. Right? So you have very different behaviors among the different customers. And certainly, we are getting improved. increasing customer feedback through, I guess, the me. I think things like TripAdvisor, where and even in YouTube, Facebook, where the information about our products that we no longer can control, whether we want to or not, if you need to pay attention to what's being said about your product.
Okay, terrific. Pickling, what about you?
Actually, just to connect that as a bookend, Andreas and I had a discussion about the power of the internet. We were talking about TripAdvisor or TravelAdvisor.com. And nowadays, when we go for travel, you can virtually plan your whole trip just by asking people from different websites how they felt about a hotel, a place, a site, or whatever. And they even have pictures. You could actually dream and visualize your whole trip even before you got on the plane. And that really is, that is the microcosm of how the world has changed. Let me give you an example from Singtel. We have one of the largest customer care centers in this part of the world. We've got 1,500 seats in Malaysia, Singapore, listening to phone calls, complaints, help lines, and so on. And yet, that's not the thing that really makes us all jump. The thing that makes us all jump, and I'm not teaching all of you what to do, is that every one of you who is a Singtel customer, who is not even a Singtel customer, has access to all of us. You know, you know how to get to us on the internet. You know how to send your complaints to us. And we were talking about this yesterday. I have 2.8 million subscribers. And yet, what moves the company is that less than 0.03% actually complain. That's less, if you work it out, it's less than about, it's just a few thousand people. And of that few thousand, less than 1,000 are the most vociferous complainers, probably in the world. And that actually causes us to take a look at ourselves. So you can imagine, less than 1,000 people can move a company that is worth billions in market cap. And that really tells you how the consumer, the push and pull between the institution and the consumer, how it has changed so dramatically.
Okay. How would I put this? I think, very embarrassingly again, we have complex relationships with our customers. And why is it complex? I think we struggle to understand our customers simply because we deal with a whole spectrum of people, because the bank that I'm with is a universal bank. So we deal with all segments of customers, and we offer a whole range of products. That's the second complexity. We offer multi-channels. And if you look at it, what do people want of banking? It's very easy to say we, as in you tell us what you want of banking. But end of the day, what is most sensitive to individuals? And as Andreas said, at the end of the day, we are driven by certain self-interest, and that's monetary self-interest. That's the bottom line. And banking is about dealing with your most basic of self-interest, money. So many guys can say many things about banks, but at the end of the day, we turns quickly to me, as in, I want to know where my money is, right? And you better get it right the first time we are talking or communicating or dialoguing. So it's a complex business in the sense that on both sides, the banks don't know really what the customers want, and customers also flip from me or we to quickly I, as in my money.
Andreas, go ahead.
Yeah, I would like to actually point out a difference here, and that's really, who is me? The question about what makes an individual individual. In the case of OCBC, it's the money. And it's the identity which is coupled to my passport, because that's the document which I had when I opened the account. In the case of the carrier, it's clearly my SIM card. Not the phone, but the SIM card, which has my identity, which of course can be used for many things, payment, etc. Now, in the case of travel, actually, ultimately, none of that. In the case of travel, it is some identity which I have, and I don't mean when I create information on the web, I don't mean as an anonymous creator, because I don't trust anybody who just has an anonymous entry. But as a pseudonym. Pseudonym means as somebody with a persistent history over time. And for that, it often doesn't matter what name I have. The same is true at trading bulletin boards, so it actually reaches for travel or for finance, other areas. But I think the question is really, how do we as a society deal with identity in the next 5 years, 10 years? Is it like in Korea, where people need to give their social security number in order to get internet access? Is it like in other countries, where you can just go and buy a SIM card for anything and you don't have to show a passport? You pay cash. So I think that's the question where I think I'm struggling with. What actually, how do we deal with the multiple identities we have? And I don't mean just one on Facebook, one at school, one email address there, but even maybe at Facebook that we have different subviews, different friends. Relationships are not binary. You know, they're multidimensional. Many dimensions to it. Maybe he calls me first and I never return the call. Maybe I call him first. So I think it's actually more complex, both the me business, what's identity, and the we business, what is relationship. And it's fun to think about these things.
What's interesting to me about that is it implies a fair amount of, you've got to have the ability to sift through the information that you're getting, right? Whether it's the digital exhaust on the very basic level, to the more paying closer attention to the two-way dialogue that you might see. How do companies separate noise that is everything that's out there versus actual meaning that's coming out of these identities that you're writing? Thoughts on that? Anybody?
Okay, maybe let me start off in a way, representing a very legacy industry and an industry which is very regulated and increasingly nationalized. What is identity? Identity for us is legal and formal. So in a way, that adds complexity in the journey for us, although on a personal level, I understand fully why institutions like us must quickly move from the e-business, which is about just using the web for what I call efficient and effective processing, to me. I'm not sure about the we, right? I need to be convinced about the we, but definitely the me, yes. How do we engage with customers where we can enjoin with them in greater collaboration, where we will benefit and they will benefit. But with regards to identity, we are regulated, and I said it's complex because as we move from E to me and me to E, customers and the bank, end of the day, customers will also want assurance for us that it is I, which is the formal and legal.
Michael, you look like you want to jump in.
Well, I suppose we're at the opposite end of the spectrum, and I suppose you said before that you were the most basic need, human need, which is money. I might argue in our hotels, the most basic human needs are satisfied, but also
I thought I was asleep.
But ours is also our business is all about choice, and we don't. You know, once somebody puts money in your bank, you have a constant relationship with them, at least for a period of time. Whereas in the hotel business, going back to the data, I mean, we literally have millions of people stay with us every night around the world, and there's too much data. So the challenge is which data do you want? How do you deal with that? And then which customers, which guests do you want to have a continuous relationship with? Because you can't have a relationship, not a meaningful relationship, with everyone who stays in your hotel. So and that's where you have a hierarchy. Again, this is probably going back more to the E than the B traditionally in the last 10 years. you have a hierarchy of relationships, and you narrow it down to what you consider to be your loyal customers that you can influence the decisions. And that's the pyramid. Now, that's absolutely changing in today's environment with you, and you can get to more people in a different way.
Okay.
Do
you have a take on that?
Yeah, I'm in an industry that I think allows me to see a lot of different technologies. This thing about identity, and I'm glad you use the word noise, because as I said, in my industry, and in the telecommunications industry, our raison d'etre for being around, the first thing is to allow you to communicate. But then we realize that as you become more and more empowered, I become less and less sure of what I can push to you. So basically, if you take on multiple identities, for example, if you like to play on the internet, you like to take on a different persona, and I want to be there with you, then I've got to be able to anticipate that and sell you software, sell you pipes that allow you to get there and have fun. And then if you want to be your legal self, for example, I got to be able to help the banks run a pipe directly to you. And then if you want to play games, and then you want to play games with friends, I've got to have technology on a phone, for example, that enables you not just to play, but also to play all the time, so that you can play on your phone, and then when you get to Starbucks, you can go and play on a Wi-Fi, in a Wi-Fi area with your laptop. And then when you get home, I give you a TV set that allows you to continue playing on a bigger screen. So as time goes on, I lose control of what I can push to you. And when we talk about the me and the we economy, revolution, however you put it, we first get to a converged state where there are many things that I can push to you, but then when you go beyond that, you control companies such that customization is the end point. And then we'll start to see whether individual companies can keep up or whether it's total industries that have to partner together to satisfy all the different yous that you would like to be. So that's a state that we're moving towards. It's interesting for me as an interested participant to see this evolution, and trust me, it's going very, very quickly. We were talking, I'll give you an example. In Korea, for example, Korea is probably one of the most wired nations in the world. In terms of broadband, they're probably ahead, probably the first. And then there's Japan, and then there's probably Singapore and a few other countries. And we were talking about this, yesterday we were talking about Second Life. Well, the Koreans, the Korean telco has actually come up with a software that allows you to change your identity on Second Life. Basically, all you have to do is take a picture of yourself, and then you can become anything you want. You can change your hair, you can change your eyebrows, you can change your lips, you can change your ears, you can change your sex, you can even change, you can even become an animal with your face. You can become anything you want. And it, to me, it was a revelation that, my gosh, you know, we would go to that extent so that you can be you, or you can be whatever you think you want to be on Second Life. And that really blows your mind. If you have telcos that are going around developing this kind of software, and mind you, they have a whole building of about 500 PhDs developing apps that you and I have not heard of yet. And that's the kind of change that is happening in this world today.
Andres, let me tap into something that he's triggered there, and it's this notion. And then, by the way, I want to turn questions over to the audience in just a moment, because I know there's some questions out there. But one of the things that Pickling mentioned there was companies losing control increasingly. It's becoming more driven by us, all of us, right? But what are the literal implications that has? I mean, on the one hand, we're advocating, look, this is a great way to learn. It's a great way for us to even conceivably monetize it someday. but more importantly, just to learn about what we can do to help customers. But what are the implications of letting these companies consider this?
Control is so last millennium. Let's see where we can say that.
Yeah. Wait, let me just jump in. I just got an SMS from OCBC.
Did you just send that?
And to show the control, I will delete it.
Okay. So I think ultimately we have to think about when we talk about control. What are the scarcities in a given day and age? And what is your scarcest good? It's your attention. Not your time, but ultimately it's your attention. So people try to control your attention. People try to rape your attention by having that pissy television ad, that phone ring, just like your phone ring, oh, my phone, and then you realize, no, someone just raped your attention. So I think what we should think about is, how do people deal with, you know, expected value, and how do people deal with extreme values? That you just fill something into those cells on that board. That's up there. Teaching about boards doesn't matter.
All right.
And I think an important decision of how you use these data and what data you as a personal data strategy should reveal is the question about what is your relationship to those four cells. So this one here is positive, benefit, good things. This one here is negative, costs, bad things. So in economics, when you talk about utility, you typically talk about a mix of those two cells. But let's actually decouple this. So the cost is the integral from minus infinity to zero of your distribution. So that's the half-sided, you know, value of what's getting negative. And similarly, the benefit is in your 0 to infinity of your distribution. So that's what we expect to gain on average at this moment. That's what we expect to pay on average to save. So you can also flip it around. So if I send you a short message, then what is the cost for you? Like, what was the cost for OCBC that you got bothered by this app? Question. Okay. But these are here sample values.
Probably nothing, because we did it in conjunction with them.
Now, what's new on the web is that we now have those low probability events, like the extreme could be I go on the dating site and I find the partner of my life, or I win the lottery, something like that. And the worst case is, well, what we see in pilots right now, that existences disappear, people commit suicide, they don't know what to do anymore. Acquaintance of mine in Germany got convinced by a CEO of a large company to just put in 500 million, to get a loan for 500 million from a bank to happen out. And unfortunately, that is worth the entire thing, which was 1.3 million at the time, now 200 million. So that poor woman is 30 million in the negative. That's kind of bad, you know? So that's it. Now, what we know is that on average, this cell is twice as big as that cell. So if I win it all, I'm only half as happy as I'm unhappy when I lose it all. So we know things in general, but what really the question is for companies to interact, for us to send ads to each other, for us to deal with our scarce field of attention is, what is our relationship here to those four cells? And so it's a framework which I think is very useful for you to think about, what do you want to put out on Facebook? Companies, for instance, don't pay insurance bills anymore, health insurance, because of what people said on Facebook. Very interesting. Or in United Arab Emirates, you have a GPS device in your car, which automatically, when you're speeding, takes money off your bank account.
Well, let me turn it over then. Thank you, Chris. Questions in the audience. We have two microphones, and one in each aisle. We'd love it if you could come forward and ask a question. And just tell us your name, and very quickly, just a very crisp, succinct question. Anybody want to take a stab at this? there's a brave soul out there. I know there is. All right, Wilder, go ahead, please.
Hello, my name is Jens Hofmann. I've been living in Singapore for a couple of years. I'm running a couple of internet-related businesses. And I think it's, the room is small enough. I think I'm repeating. Actually, what we heard is that people want to contribute and we can profit as a business from people contributing. But I think what we have not heard about is that people might not want to contribute. And I have one business in Germany which I run very in your terms one. Zero or e-business, because I think some people just want to buy a pair of jeans or a pair of shoes, no question asked. And I want to give them the impression that we do not do any data mining or anything. And I think this is interesting because the number of people who do not want that, who do not want to expose themselves at all, is growing. Maybe not in this part of the world, because I think Europeans or Americans have a bigger urge for privacy. I find there are so many questions asked here in Singapore when I want to sign up for something that I question, but, well, my fellow citizens here don't question them. But I try to stay away from that, and I am looking for businesses who say, we don't ask questions, we do not mind what you're doing, we sell you a product, and this is it, period.
So and that means that simply in this matrix here, you have very little expected benefits from this of having those genes, because... You know, it's like the story of the bait. You don't give the fish the bait which you like, but you give the fish the bait the fish likes. So maybe you shouldn't buy the genes you like, but you maybe should buy the genes somebody else likes. But if you don't put value on here, the positive one, then you just consider the cost and you those basically don't want to share any data. So I think it's just one of the extreme cases of downweighting the top and upweighting the bottom.
So you think I'm like an extreme case?
No, look,
or do you think there is a big number of people
I was referring to that earlier. We host millions of people a year. And just because they stay in our hotel and we collect information on those people, and very obviously the Information Privacy Act varies from country to country, a lot of people, they don't want to be contacted us because they stay in our hotel. So we need to be careful, exactly that, about who we communicate with and about what. So I agree with you. It's not just a blanket, right, I have your information now, and I think in today's world, absolutely, getting unsolicited information can be a cost negative. Absolutely.
But the question is, what value do they get out of it? If the next time they get that lovely room with a window, which they had last time, which they really enjoyed, they're probably not unhappy. If you're on the other screw them and saying, hey, I know you're coming anyways, I give you the room without a window.
Some people aren't coming back. They've come to Singapore once, right? And they stay in this particular hotel. And if they don't travel, we all get a lot of information. That's not the information that I want. So we need to find that there are, but on the other hand, absolutely, there are people that travel a lot that we want to communicate with regularly, and we need to give them the information and it stimulates them and excites them. But we need to, it's not for everybody.
That's a good point, because you're really raising the issue of what's intrusive versus what people want to volunteer, right?
My point is, it's the only way to go as a company doing business on the internet to use all the methods and the technologies you mentioned. Or isn't there a second way that I say, I cannot provide to everybody what they want, but there is a group of people who might want it another way. And I think this group of people is growing. And if you're looking like 5 or 10 years ahead, the hip people will be the one who are not on Facebook and who will probably buy their stuff not online but offline, just like because it becomes too insane what is happening. You don't know what happens with the data. And I think your group, I think you also have these, I think from within, and Etat is also in the other group. I think this is a very good example. This is for people who haven't traveled to Europe, a very bare-bone thing. If you go to the Formule Hotel, it's an automized thing. You don't even see anybody. It is the most bare-bone thing you can get. You want a clean bed and a shower. And this is an excellent product. No question asked. I don't even have to look at somebody. I just put in my credit card, a key.
Your credit card? So you're revealing your identity by putting your credit card, just for the record. I mean, if you were traveling with cash only, and of course not taking airplanes, because that's where you have to pay. Last year I did a talk at CIMA, the Scandinavian Interactive Media Conference, with a former spy, who died, an American who used to hang out in the Russian waters, submarines, listen to what these guys call it. And in preparation for that, we had a woman disappear for 1 week in San Francisco. boy, was that hard work. I mean, she couldn't use her mobile phone. Lots of work. Everything in cash, of course. So what I'm saying is, there is data which you are not aware, tracing which you are not aware of, you know, but just think about my Skynet data, who knows who is falling in favor, who is falling out of favor, all of that. Very difficult to actually really live in the cash economy. Do you have cameras in Singapore on the streets? I don't know. But yeah, you do. Okay. So this means you have to walk around with a hat, maybe a sock over your face, and I'm not sure how you know long you'd be. It doesn't talk for that.
No, but I don't think that's the point that he's raising. The point that he's raising is some people don't want a relationship.
Yeah.
Right? And that's where you have to be careful.
Yeah, exactly, because I'm asking for a clean bed and a shower and not for a relationship.
Because that would be a different hotel.
I might put a clean bed, but that's not your business.
So, yeah, but it fits in the framework really beautifully, that you just don't see benefits and you want to minimize the cost and risk.
Good point. All right. Other questions from the audience? I thought I saw another hand or two jump up over on the right side.
I'd like to answer that.
Oh, please.
You've raised an interesting point, but let me just make just one starting point. You'd be surprised at how little information that you give, and even that can be data mined. You'd be very surprised. So let me just say that as a starting point. But, okay, you mentioned about in the East. What I can tell you from my own experience is that there are two worlds here. There is the virtual world, and there is the physical world. When you come to this part of the world, especially Singapore, when you're in the physical world, a lot of data is asked of you. Where you come from, how long you've been, you know, the whole long list. But when you get into the virtual world, into any of the websites here, not so much the government websites, but any of the websites to purchase things, the laws of the virtual world kick in. And there are very few things that can be asked, even from a rather intrusive society like Singapore, where we like to ask lots of questions. From my company, trust me, there's a lot of things that are only permission-based. We're regulated by an authority that wants us to be very light as far as information is concerned, because it is aware that the virtual world very often is not the same as the physical world. So from that viewpoint, we're conforming in many ways to what you're used to, you know, when you come from other parts of the world. So that's the second thing. The third is that while people, you know, there are some people who don't want relationships and they just want to have a product and so on. But the bottom line is that every institution that wants to sell something wants to sell it in a better way. So you still want to know from people who don't want relationships what the happiest way without relationships. So you still go out and you still try and find to the best of your ability. How can I make them happy even though they don't want a relationship with us? It's institutional curiosity, because it comes from wanting to offer a better product, you know? So that's my take on that one.
Andrew, any thoughts on this at all? You want to jump in from the...
No, actually, we struggle with that because we know that we have to move. We operate in a legacy world, and we'll continue to operate in a legacy world because we are a controlled or regulated industry. And indeed, I think most of our customers, with powerful learning lessons at this point in time in history, will want banking to be somewhat regulated and managed, right? But we also understand the need for us to form more meaningful relationships, and that comes through interactions, from communications, and like it or not, from data, because where we stand, and a minimal amount of our transactions is actually face-to-face. Most of it is today remote. So, and this is funny because although most of our transactions are remote, that means we don't see our customers, right? Yet customers, that's why I said much earlier that we have complex relationships with our customers. You ask a customer, what do you want, all right? it will say, I want more branches, right? Although they don't transact the branches. And this is something which I think is to do with the cyclic, is to do with money, is to do with the sense that you are around because you have my money. So with data, I think Pickling is right. Like it or not, every time you transact with us, we gather more data on you. And we are an industry where, in breakfast dialogue with Andres yesterday, he asked me what is banking about. And I said basically three things, right? One is risk management. That's how we make our money. We take our money, we lend it out, we take a spread out of it. Two is data management. So like it or not, every day we deal with millions of data flowing through. We have millions of transactions going through. And the third part is actually trying to form a relationship through the data, forming a profile of you, whether it's behavioral. And from there, we predict or we somehow define a profile of you where, I mean, this was not staged at SMS. Yeah, we do push marketing. Primitive, but we
do. Everyone know what's funny? He was trying to sell me jeans.
Yes, and in a way, yeah, in our own primitive way, trying to move to the me and we, but not quite there.
So one thing I think we need to see here, and that's the point in the conversation I had with Mike in preparation for this tour here, was that ultimately it is your core product that matters. So what is happening on the web, what's happening in people contributing, people talking about you, is that those things which you're good at will shine. And those things you suck at will also be, you know, pretty much visible. And I personally think, you know, that's a good thing. And I think it's a better world in reducing that uncertainty and having actually people help you reduce that uncertainty. And the price you pay is that, of course, there is more data around there. And that's why I emphasize in the talk that what is the main purpose of all this data which we generate? The main purpose for me is to have us use our precious good, namely our attention, in a way that is more satisfying to us. And, you know, I call it relevance function. And if we don't want, you know, our data to end in the relevance function, then we just have the generic one, which is something the company organizes, company optimizes, given that they know nothing about me. And it's not hard to do better than that. And I think that's the perspective I really would like to bring to your attention here, that your scarce good of your attention is what, with data and metadata, actually can be used more satisfying for yourselves.
Terrific. Good point. Oh, question?
I think it's about understanding the trade-offs. It's about understanding the trade-offs you have. There is no black and white. It is about educating people, and in some way I think it's great as SMU puts on the lecture on this topic, because it's part of the education, of seeing the trade-offs, one, and secondly, seeing where you, for whatever reason, stand in this 2x2 matrix.
Let me just clarify that. When we talk about data mining, it's maybe we've been watching too many movies and people try and extract all kinds of information. But let me just try and explain what getting data and trying to mine that is on the internet. And let me just take the Amazon example. The Amazon example to me is the gold standard for the kind of information that we are looking for. And I don't think you find that intrusive if you're on, let's say, you're looking for a movie, and then you go onto Amazon.com and say, okay, click, I like this one. The moment you pick that, there is a very powerful inference engine behind that individual, just one purchase. And it starts to push to you. People who buy this would, you know, usually like to look at, and then boom, four or five other choices are offered to you. Now, you don't find that intrusive, but you actually find that, that's actually pretty good, you know. Yeah, I kind of like this genre, and I kind of like, you know, and they would see, and then they'll say, want to see more? And then you click, and then some more come out. That's the kind of data that is relevant when we're talking about the internet. It's not intrusive. It's like, what color would you like? You know, it's for want of a better word, it is an inference. It infers that you would like certain things. And in time to come, when companies get into the Web 2.0 and the Web 3.0, that kind of information is going to be very commonplace. The kind of offers that you get will be very commonplace, where the moment you pick something, five other choices come. For example, I've just found, and forgive me for self-advertisement, but we have an e-shop, and I just discovered today that one of these companies has picked us as a kind of like best in class for mobiles. So basically, what was behind the interface that you see? If you click that you like a particular phone, whether it's Nokia, whether it's Samsung or Sony Ericsson, and you click that you want it at a certain price, then there'll be a prompt, would you like to see more? And all of a sudden, you get the whole range of mobiles that are in that price range with the kind of, like, if you want a camera or if you want MMS and you want SMS or whatever, you know, it will, all of a sudden, you see four or five of that. Now, that's the kind of flexibility that data is trying to get, that all companies are trying to get. So I hope I've clarified that it's not about your personal data, it's about your purchasing behavior and what companies think you would like. That's the whole thinking behind data mining in this particular case.
Andreas, I would imagine you would agree. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to actually ask you, as you talked about identity, for a question to the panel. Is it mere semantics if in one case we talk about pushing that to the customer, and the other case you allow the customer to discover mobile phones? So is there something more to it? I personally think it is. More to it than just calling it push in one case where you don't like it and discover it in the case where you like it. What do people think?
I mean, we're in the business of attracting additional guests, so you have to be out there pushing information, right? And obviously there's a cost to delivering that information, so the more targeted that you can be in giving the right preference to the right people, the better and more efficient you will be.
I'll give one example. If you go to an airport lounge in Europe, and there are always these Wi-Fi zones, but the thing about going to Europe is that these Wi-Fi zones come with a cost. Well, some companies have found a way to advertise, and they create something that is called ultramercials. I'm not sure whether you've heard of that word, but basically, when you sit down, you open your laptop, you turn it on, and there'll come a prompt. And the prompt is, if you want to serve for free, click here. If not, just click delete, and then you can continue doing your Wi-Fi. And they say, we will pay for you for the next 15 minutes or half an hour. But in order to get 15 minutes or half an hour for free, you have to click your way through that advertisement. It's a car company that does that, for example. But these are some of the ways that advertisers or that companies are trying to bend the rules between push and attraction. This is what I want. it offers you something that you want, which is the free time, because it can be quite expensive. But in order to do that, you have to see something, a product of theirs. So these are some of the, could we say, more innovative offerings that companies are coming out with now.
You could argue that instead of paying with your money, you could pay your attention.
And time and attention, correct.
We're rapidly running out of time. Oh, quick question here. Last question, in fact, because we're running out of time. Go ahead.
Thank you for letting me ask the question.
Of course.
So my question is, you know, there's, who wants the data ultimately? Because, you know, if we have all this data, and maybe you could argue that more personalization is better. So Google has data on me, Amazon has data on me, Facebook has data on me, all these companies have data. So if you could pull it together, then just my health information, my insurance, so I guess the more you pull it together, perhaps you get to be more personalized. My question is, who wants the data, and how do you see all the data being shared? Because they're all in these separate silos. So that ultimately, if you can transfer them or put them in one place, then they're more valuable.
But then
how should I answer?
The ultimate question. Any thoughts?
Sorry, I have to. We're building an inference engine, so maybe I can help with that. Ultimately, the data is not about you personally. I think the data is about your consumption and your consumption patterns and your interests. Now, over time, your consumption patterns, your interests change. So that the data that we had about you before is no longer relevant. So inference engines are such that they will tease out new information from you all the time. So in a sense, it is about you, the individual, but it isn't about holding your DNA because your tastes change over time. So in that sense, it is amorphous. You know, it changes over time. So hopefully that answers that. You know, that nobody actually owns it. It's just that if you, as I always say to Generation Y people, one day you become Generation X because you will grow up to that. You will hit that age. And then your interests change. If you marry, your interests change. If you have kids, your interests change. And inference engines will tease that out, you know, from you. So from that perspective, the information we had of you, of somebody like you, is no longer relevant 5 years down the line, for example.
So Andreas, just to wrap it up here, because we gotta conclude here, but who does own this thing? It's a good provocative question. You deal with this a lot.
It is, again, such a question of, you know, the last millennium, the question about who owns the data. I mean, once you release something somewhere, it's out there. So the question of data ownership, what does it mean? What does it mean to own something? That you can sell it, it's there already. That you can delete it, it's there already. So I think the question is just much more about what's your data strategy? And what benefits can you derive, and where in those two dimensions actually do you sit? If you see the risks really as very serious, then you want to avoid revealing data about yourselves. And the example I gave are all about trade-offs. And so I think who owns the data is who can actually help you fix the data if something is wrong about you. So it's sort of second-order questions, which are the questions now. If somebody says something which is not true about you, who do you go to say not true about me? If there are already 100 copies out of in the internet, which people might see at higher page rank than the true data.
Thank you. Well, I've got to tell you, I think this is fascinating because what we've discussed, obviously, is this notion of how you can not only use the data to learn a bit more about your customer, but also how you can transform it in a sense to create, ultimately, a two-way dialogue. It may not be applicable in all situations, and obviously you see companies wrestling with a variety of constraints, but the bigger issues are how are you going to use the data that you're getting in a way that can make it far more productive for you, or, as you pointed out in your earlier question, you don't want to be bothered with it. How can companies protect that and maintain that level of trust? These questions are not going to disappear. They're going to continue to grow in different markets. And I think it's a fascinating time to be a part of and witnessing all of this. I'd like to take this time to thank our panel. Michael Eisenberg, thank you very much. With Acorn. Chuck Peckman. Andrew Lee, and of course, our guest of honor today, our speaker, Andreas Wagen. Thank you so much. thank you all of you there as well for coming.
And by the way, I'm around. Some of us are around. If somebody wants to grab some bite, go to Hawker Center or something like this, I'm very happy to continue discussion in an informal setting.
Good. Well, and we've got guests, or gifts for each of you. Sorry.